Hi, everybody. My name is Lee, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lee.
And it sure is wonderful to be back in Arkansas and here in Eureka Springs and to be able to come and participate at the Silver Anniversary, the 25th Annual Springtime in the Ozarks Conference. Thank you very much. I appreciate the committee and Mike's phone calls and letters. And Lloyd, a really good friend of mine, spoke here last year, Matt G. And right after Matt got back, I called him up and said, tell me all about it, you know. And he said, oh, he had a fantastic time and how great it was to be here and everything. I said, who else spoke? He told me who spoke, and I said, well, I guess that's one of those committees that likes to have at least one rotten, nasty, stinking, sorry, low-down alcoholic on its program. He said, yeah, you know. I said, well, that's just great. And about a week later, I got a call from Lloyd. And now I'm convinced. This is one of these kind of outfits that likes to have at least one rotten, nasty, stinking, sorry, low-down, scumbag, lying alcoholic. You know, my kind of alcoholic. And I really do appreciate you, your invitation to having me here. I've got a lot of friends here this weekend, and it means a lot to me that Joe and Charlie are out here tonight. They know how much I think about them, and Scott and Linda. And what a talk Linda gave today. Man, if you missed that Al-Anon talk, you can still get that tape. That was absolutely fantastic. And Gene and I quit saying amen a long time ago. And it's good to see Marcy from the Western Club. And Larry is a special friend of mine. Larry's the only guy that I know from my past that's sober. And we've got a friend that we just both love. And we don't know what happened to him. And I was talking to Larry today about that. And Larry said, I guess everybody just loved him too much. And I said, boy, that can happen, you know. But it's always so, it means so much to me to see you and to see you here in Alcoholics Anonymous and doing well. And I love you so much. It was good to see Rick and Kay to do a fine service for Alcoholics Anonymous. David A. said there's three kinds of alcoholics. Drinking alcoholic, sober alcoholic, and dead alcoholic. And today I am a sober alcoholic. And I know, and there's no doubt in my mind, that the only reason that I am sober is because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried everything. When I drank alcohol, I could not control the amount of alcohol that I would drink. And when that caused me enough trouble, I quit forever. And I found out that I could not quit. And I was licked. And I could not do it without your help. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me full provision, a complete program that I know that can keep me sober for the rest of my life. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love you. And I know that I cannot make it without you. My sobriety date is November the 20th, 1984. I did not pick that day. If I could have picked one, I would have picked a better day than that. I would have picked Christmas or the 4th of July or something like that. But who gets to pick their sobriety day? You know, that's one of the things we don't get to do around here. I picked a whole bunch of them, you know. They just didn't take. My home group is the Central Group on the corner of Highway 50 and Broadway in downtown Orlando. We have 51 meetings a week. Just to give you an idea of the character of my home group, I was down in Vero Beach sometime back, and I attended a meeting, and the topic was the gifts of sobriety. And the first lady shared, she said, serenity, you know, and she talked about serenity and how much it meant to her to have peace of mind and to be able to relax and be content and be satisfied from within herself and stuff. And the next guy shared, and he said integrity and what it meant to him to be able to hold down a job and meet his commitments and be where he says he's going to be and do what he says he's going to do. And the next lady shared, she said fulfillment, you know, and how much it meant to her to work with other alcoholics and what it meant to her to be significant in the lives of other people and things like that. And I said, boy, what a fantastic topic. When I get back to the Central Group, I'm going to bring that topic up. And my first opportunity, I was at Central, and I said, we're going to talk about the gifts of sobriety. And the first little lady over here said, tea. Guy over here said, early parole. Fellow over here said, pants. The one next to him looked at him and said, "Dry pants." And you would love the Central Group. And if you're ever in Orlando, please come and visit us. I had a thinking problem a long time before I had a drinking problem. My earliest memory in life as a child is laying in bed at night and having imaginary conversations and practicing these conversations and thinking that if I say this to this kid, you know, maybe they'll say this back to me, and when I go to school tomorrow, I'll try this out. And I would go to school and I would try these conversations out that I practiced in an effort to try to fit in with others and to communicate with others. I was someone that always felt less than inferior to and fearful of everything and everybody around me. And, you know, as a result of coming here to Alcoholics Anonymous and receiving the education that we receive here, I can identify my problem as complete self-obsession. I was just obsessed with myself and the complete self-centeredness that we have. And, of course, we have an answer for that today. And today I know that when I walk into a room, you know, I have tools that I can use, and I can look around and try to find some way I can make a contribution to whatever group. Maybe it's in business, or shake someone's hand and try to do something for someone else, make someone else feel comfortable. And I can immediately get out of that. But I didn't have any tools then. And there was always some kid around that was just perfect in every way. He just seemed perfect. He would dress nice. He made good grades. The teachers all loved him. He would say appropriate things. He had blonde hair. I just hate this kid's guts, and I was really mean to him, you know. And I'd like to say I grew out of that, but I didn't, because when I was in junior high, I played football, basketball, baseball, ran track, you know, in an effort to try to fit in with a group of people. And I was big, so I could play all these sports. They used to tease me and tell me, "Lee, you were born big. You were born on the 18th, 19th, and 20th of June, so I could play all these sports." And, you know, I made some accomplishments. My football team came in all-conference one year. I came in fourth place in a 20-mile marathon once, and a third place in a 440-yard dash in a state event, you know. But in spite of these accomplishments, they were not sufficient for me to overcome this problem I had with myself. And there was always some guy on the team that would never drop the ball, and he was just perfect in every way, it seemed like. And the teachers all liked him. He always got the girl, had blonde hair. I just hate this guy's guts. When I was in high school, about 15 years old, I became very interested in girls. And I lived with my grandparents. The reason I lived with my grandparents, my mother and father had a lot of trouble. I've lived long enough to make a lot of the same mistakes that they made, and I understand it so much better today. But living with my grandparents there in the community we lived in, there was a little girl that lived nearby that I was just nuts about. And she was just gorgeous. And I would see her, you know, I'd be at school, and I would know that I would see her there at school, you know, and I would be talking to a buddy of mine, maybe in class. We'd be standing there talking, and she would walk in the room, you know, where we were at. And she would come over, maybe to stand right next to me, you know. And out of the corner of my eye, I could just kind of see her skin, you know. I could see her hair. I could smell her. My mind would start racing. I couldn't think. I couldn't breathe. You know, I'd have to run out the door. I couldn't stand to be in her presence. And we would have these ball games after, these dances in the gym after the games and stuff. And I'd be there, and I'd be at the dance, and I'd see her there. And I would look over at her and say, "There she is. Oh, boy, I love her so much. She's so good looking, you know. I'm going to go talk to her tonight. Tonight I'm going to talk to her. I'm going to ask her to dance, you know. And I'm going to hold her in my arms. And we're going to walk outside and walk in the moonlight, you know. And I'm going to tell her I love her. And it's going to be great, you know." And that song would end, and I'd say, "Well, maybe after the next song I'll ask her to dance, you know." And that song would end, I'd say, "Well, maybe after the next one." And then some guy with blonde hair would walk over there and ask her to dance. Screw the whole deal up for me. You know, I'd be at my grandparents' house, and I'd peek through the windows, and I'd watch as she would drive home, you know. And she was a couple years older than me and was a cheerleader and had a car. And she'd get out of that car with those pom-poms and run inside her house. And I'd look at her and go, "Wow, you know, one day. You know, and it just never came, you know. And, you know, I guess I would still be that kind of guy today. I would still be someone that was just unable to communicate or talk to anybody. But one day, a magical and wonderful thing happened to me when my grandparents were gone. A buddy of mine came over with two bottles of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. And I drank one bottle, and he drank the other one. And in a matter of 10 minutes, I was standing out on the roof of my grandparents' house screaming out my declaration of love, you know, for this girl. You know? All that fear was gone. I felt like I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof. omnipotent. And that's the way I always wanted to feel. And I stood up there and I just screamed out, "You make the sun shine and you make the stars come up at night." And just when my grandfather came home, he drug me off the roof and put me in bed. And when I came out of that the next day, I said, "Oh boy." And I found what I'd been looking for. And I made it a point to drink alcohol every opportunity I had since then. And I was still in school, you know, and I'd meet with my buddies on the way to school in the morning. We'd pool our lunch monies, and you'd get a case of Boone's Farm for $7.20. And we would start drinking on that first thing in the morning. You know, why wait until evening to feel so good? And we would hide it in lockers underneath the cars and stuff like that. And you don't get to drink that way in high school and not get into a lot of trouble. So, of course, I immediately started getting into a lot of trouble. And I drank a lot, and I loved it. I thought it was a compliment. People would come to me and say, "Boy, you sure do drink a lot." And I'd say, "Oh, thank you," you know. I had an unquenchable thirst for alcohol. I had an unquenchable thirst for alcohol from the very get-go. You know, I don't know when I became an alcoholic. All I know is that I added alcohol to my body. And alcohol did something special for me from the very beginning. And I would lay out for 2 or 3 days at a time and worry my grandparents. You know, and I'd come home and my grandmother would say, "Lee, where have you been? You know, I've been worried sick, you know. Why don't you call us, you know? We just want to know if you're alive or dead." And I would sit with my grandmother. And many, many times I've sat with my grandmother and she'd throw her arms around me and be crying. I'd say, "That's it, Grandma. No more. It's those guys I'm hanging out with. It's their drinking is what's getting me drunk. And I'm not going to do it again." You know, on the first day would be okay, and the second day would be okay. And on that third day, I'd be pacing the floor back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Walk outside, walk around the house 10 times, come back in. My grandmother would say, "Lee, are you hungry? Can I fix you a sandwich?" I'd say, "Get off my back. You know, stop watching me. You're smothering me. You're bothering me. How do you expect me to have any kind of life or go anywhere or be anybody with the way you treat me?" And I just, boom, blow out the door. And I did not know that when I would leave that I was headed toward a drink of alcohol. I did not know that. And I would go, and I would drink, and that alcohol would cure that madness, and I could be at peace again. The guys I hung out with, they wanted to drink the same way I wanted to drink. We didn't have any money, and so we would steal. And I know that when I first started stealing, it really bothered me. The men in my family did not steal. That was not my example. The men in my family worked and took care of their families and were responsible. So when we first started stealing, boy, I felt real bad. You know, but later I learned to just accept it. And still later, I got to where I just loved it, you know, and I wanted to steal something from everybody. When I was 16 years old, I was in juvenile court. My grandfather heard about that and ran down there and said, "Oh my God, we've got to help that boy," you know. And when I was 17 years old, I was in civil court. My grandfather heard about that and ran down there and said, "Oh my God, what will the neighbors think?" When I was 18 years old, I would walk down the road where my grandparents lived. My grandfather would see me and run inside the house screaming at my grandmother, "Oh my God, he's coming back," you know, and he'd run inside and warn my grandmother and grab his tools and his guns and start locking those things up and hiding those. My grandmother would grab her purse and her jewelry. By the time I would hit the door, she'd be clutching her purse to her like this, and my grandfather would be standing with his arm over the portable television set. And that was the last place I would ever go. I would go there when I was just sick and hungry and dirty and tired. No place left to go. But I would go there because I knew my grandmother would feed me and I could just try to regroup. I drank until I had to get sober. And I stayed sober until I had to get drunk. And I do not know why, at such a young age, my life became that kind of a life. I take a meeting every Wednesday night into a men's halfway facility. And there are fellows there, young men, 22 and 23 years old, that have been drinking 7 and 8 years, just the way I had been drinking. And there's an invisible line for each and every one of us. You know, mine was just very early. I was one of the sicker quickers, I guess. When I was 19 years old, I caught my first prison bit. I was not ready. I thought I was pretty tough. I'd had a few fights in those alleys. I was green. I was very green. For you that have been, I don't have to tell you. For you that haven't, take my word for it, you don't want to go. It's no picnic. Ever so often, I'll hear some tough guy out here say something like, "Boy, if anybody down there ever messed with me, I'd just whip their butt." Well, guess what? That's not the game down there. And they're not playing whip your butt. And the first thing they did was give me a job that I didn't want that I couldn't quit, you know? And they worked you down there. The half a day to those people is 12 hours. And I said, my God. I made a fantastic discovery there, too. You could get anything you want in that place. And I hooked up with my buddies, and that's how I spent my time. And alcohol helped. It would make that place endurable. Many, many, many times I'd sit and say to myself, if I ever get out of this place, I'm going to get a job. If I ever get out of here, I'm going to go to work. I'm going to be the man that my grandfather is. And I'm going to make everybody proud of me. And the day I got out, my grandparents picked me up. And I could not have been happier. I was filled with joy. I was free. My life was going to be different. I knew I'd never have to have an experience like that again. And we were driving down that old highway. And I looked down the middle of the road and I saw those stripes. And I thought to myself, what are those there for? And I know those mean something. And I could not remember what the stripes down the middle of the road were there for. And it seemed like just one thing after another like that was happening. And my second day out, I hooked up with a pint bottle of Jose Cuervo. 2 weeks later, I was with the same guys doing the same old things. And 2 months later, I was back in again. And you could take the next 12 years of my life and just stick them in the garbage can. Because I was in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. Every time I got out of jail, I thought I was free. Every time I got out, I said, I'm never going back. I just want to be a regular guy. I just want to have a job, have a car, live somewhere, have some clothes, you know, maybe go to school, have a girlfriend, what I thought anybody could have. But I'd get out and I'd have a drink, and I was back in there before I knew it. And I was absolutely clueless. Alcohol to me was not a problem. Alcohol helped. Alcohol would help me stay together. It helped me forget. It helped me to pull together another day. I took a job on the river. 30 days on, 15 days off. I made it 28 days. I wanted to kill everybody on that boat. I'd go into my quarters. I'd sleep with a pipe. I'd say, if anybody comes in here, I'll kill you. I'll kill you, you know. And I jumped the boat at 28 days, got just as drunk as I could get, called those people back 2 weeks later and just begged them for that job, and of course they wouldn't give it to me. There's always people that want to help us. Somebody suggested to me, Lee, what you need to do is get married. You find you the right woman, and she'll sell you down. And I know this is hard to imagine, and you've really got to stretch your imagination here. But believe it or not, there are women who are looking for guys that don't have jobs or cars, drink a lot of alcohol, and sleep with fives. And I found me one of them. And she broke 13 pairs of glasses right off of my face the first 18 months we were married. She'd never heard of Al-Anon. She was more like an alligator. I was watching Oprah once. Oprah asked the lady, what is it when a man strikes a woman? The lady said, that's an abusive man. Oprah asked, what is it when a woman strikes a man? Lady said, that's a woman standing up for herself. My wife stood up for herself. You know, I'd get a job, and I'd say, man, I'm going to make it every day. I'm not going to miss a minute. And I would go in there, and I'd really try, and I'd make it all week, and I'd get that paycheck on Friday, and boy, there's something special about Friday drinking. And I'm not going to do it again. I know I'm not going to get into the trouble I had last time. Boy, I'd go in that bar. Can I drag in 2 or 3 days later again, you know, and I'd try again, you know, I'd get another job and make it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, oh boy, hump day. I'm not going in that bar to get drunk. I'm just going to have a couple. I've got to unwind. I'd have 1, 2, 3. I'd never remember 4. And I'd drag back in again 2 days later. And she wouldn't understand these things. One time I was speaking with her. I said, honey, I know I haven't been the best husband, but I want you to know one thing. I'll never abandon you, you know. So she packed all her stuff and left. I moved all over. They said, Lee, go someplace else, start over. I said, that's it. Happiness is Arkansas in the rearview mirror, you know. I went to Michigan. I went to Oklahoma. I went to New York. I went to Texas. I went to Florida, you know, in an effort to start over. And the first couple of times I moved, I knew that it would be better. I knew it would be better when I got to Oklahoma. I knew it would be. But the last couple of times I moved, I didn't expect it to be any better at all. I just had to get out of town. I went to the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I ever attended in New York City. My wife had left. Most wives, when they leave, they go to the other side of town or move in with their mother or something like that. Well, she didn't do that. She went all the way to New York. She wasn't planning on coming back. And I found out how to contact her, and I called her up and just, you know, when she would leave, I'd say, good, you know, get lost. Who needs you? But a couple of weeks later, boy, I'd get hungry, and man, the rent would be due, you know, and this kind of, boy, I'd really start missing her. See, and I called her up and just, baby, you know, we can't throw away this love we've got, you know. We got all this love happening, you know. And she said, if you come up here, you're going to have to do what I tell you to do. I said, anything, you know. And I jumped in the car, and boom, 23 hours later, I was in New York City. I jumped out of the car, and I ran in the apartment building. I grabbed her in my arms. I said, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. It's going to be great. We're going to be so happy. She said, Lee, if you stay here, you're going to have to go to AA. I said, you rotten witch. You know? How are we ever going to make it with your attitude? That's how I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in the basement of a church. We walked in, the meeting had already started. It was just like this, just not this many people. There was guys standing up there speaking. We walked in, and just before I sat down, I looked over at him. I knew he was a liar the second I saw him, because he had blonde hair. Boy, I wouldn't listen to that guy at all. And anyway, after the meeting, two men came over to me and talked with me and really tried to reach me. And they talked about their drinking. And, you know, all my life, all I'd ever heard from everybody I knew in my family was, Lee, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand. And I was talking with this guy, and I shared a little with him, and he stopped me. He said, Lee, we understand. And I'd never heard anything like that before in my life. And it scared me when that guy said that. And I took a couple of steps back, and I just listened to this guy talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said that his family was together, and they were happy, and that his life was working, and all these wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told this guy, things have got to get better for me, because they just cannot get any worse. And boy, I was wrong. And I did not know that this was a progressive illness, and that it always gets worse. It wasn't long after that I moved down to Florida. The last 3 years of my drinking, I know it's only by the grace of God that I'm here at all. I cannot tell you how many times emergency vehicles came out. I have a hazy memory of flashing blue lights or red lights, somebody picking me up off the ground, my head being busted open, or police trying to straighten me out somehow. The last 3 years of my drinking, I tried everything anybody ever suggested or I could think of. I checked into a hospital once. I didn't have a nickel's worth of insurance. I begged these people, please help me, you gotta help me. And they took me, and 3 days later I was kicking that nurse's desk and cussing her out, you better let me out of here right now. And I walked straight out of that place and got as drunk as I can get. My wife took me to a minister who counseled with us and talked with us and prayed for us and things. We went to this big, huge crusade deal. And we went 3 nights in a row. And each night I sat in the top of the back balcony, in the back of the top balcony there. And at the end of each one of those services, they would say, if anybody here needs God's help, God wants to help you. And if you'll come down here, someone will pray with you. And we know God can help you. And each night I would walk from the back of the top balcony all the way down the front, and I'd pray with anybody that'd pray with me. And I was serious. And I wasn't trying to con my wife or fool anybody. I really meant business. And I knew I needed something. I knew I needed help. I knew I needed God's help or something. But I was drunk in a very short time anyway. I went to a psychiatrist. I paid her $55. I told her the truth. I told her everything. You know, I told her about my drinking. You know, I talked about the violence in our home. I told her about all my illegal activity. God, everybody knows you don't tell them that stuff. She said, okay, it'll be fine. You see, it'll be all right. You just come back, call me, come back next week. Everything'll be great. You know, I walk out the door, I just heard clunk, that deadbolt. She locked the door immediately as I walked out. I probably scared that woman to death. She probably prayed more that hour than she had in a long, long time. My last really bad drunk, I came to on the living room floor. There was glass all over the floor. I pushed the television set through the window. My wife came back to get some more of her things. And I was talking with her and trying to get her to listen to me. But she'd had it. And as she was leaving, she reached into her purse and took out a little piece of notebook paper and just zinged it to me. And I unfolded a little piece of notebook paper. And what it was a prayer. That someone had taken a piece of notebook paper and written a prayer in pencil and given my wife, trying to encourage and help her. And for the next 2 weeks, I just laid up in that apartment and I'd read that prayer over and over and over again. And I did not know where to go, and I did not know where to turn. It was 2 weeks later that I was captured again, and I wound up in the Seminole County Jail down there in Central Florida. It was there that I was separated from alcohol, and I was sick, very sick. I was 21 days worth of sick. Every day they'd take me out and arraign me on more charges. Very often we come here to Alcoholics Anonymous, unwanted, unwelcome anywhere. I was not unwanted. I was wanted. I was wanted in Orange County, Volusia County, Seminole County, New York, Arkansas, Missouri were very interested in me. I must have been a pretty interesting guy. I had charges in front of five judges. One of my sentencing judge leaned over the bench and said, I just sentenced you to every year I can give you. And I'd give you more if I could. And you are despicable. And when I got back to my cell block, I found a dictionary and I looked that word up, despicable. It said, worthy of being despised. And I said, I know that. I've known that all my life. That's no secret. I'd always felt that way. I didn't know anything at all about being through with alcohol. But I knew one thing. I was through with me. I'd had all me I could stand. And I couldn't stand another second of me. And I'd think, why was I born? Why was I even born? You know, why live here? You know, I'm not close to another human being. I don't have anyone that's interested in me. Why even be here? You know, my grandparents, every move they made in life, every thought they had was in some kind of effort to try to make me happy, and they could not make me happy. My wife, every thought she had, every move she made in life was in some effort to try to make me happy, and she could not make me happy. Every thought I had, every move I made in life was in an effort to try to make me happy. And I couldn't make me happy. And I thought life didn't mean anything. It wasn't going anywhere, and what's the use anyway? I heard there were meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous there available in the Seminole County Jail. And remembering the understanding I'd once found, I thought I'd just go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy by the name of Jerry W. would bring the meetings in every week. Jerry had never been in jail. He's just an AA member that wanted to go to jails. And I've been in a few jails. And I know that only God's people go to jails. And I can appreciate anybody that works in facilities or institutions today. And I love Scott's talk so much last night. You know, I'm here today. I know. I'm here today because a man came to a jail. Jerry came in there to save himself. But Jerry would bring a meeting in every week, and he'd bring somebody with him. And Jerry would get up, and he'd open the meeting up, and he'd talk a little bit, and then he'd have this other guy get up, and this guy would tell his story. And I'd listen to these guys, you know, and they'd talk about their drinking, and they'd talk about a solution that they found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just went week after week after week after week after week. I didn't know if AA was for me or not, but I was certainly looking for something. They shipped me over to Orange County Jail to get some charges over there. Boy, I couldn't wait to get those. And they had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to that meeting. And I went into that meeting. There was a guy standing up there, and he was speaking. He was a black guy. And now this is a guy that's done time, serious time. Boy, he really got my attention. He was talking about his life and his drinking. And then he started talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to him. And as he spoke, he had the book Alcoholics Anonymous with him. And as he spoke, he would just wave this book over his head like this. And I looked at that book and said, my God, that's a big book, you know. They'll never get me to read that big book. But this guy, he talked and he said that his life was working and he didn't have to drink one day at a time. And that he found a real answer and a way out for him, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, the next night, they asked if anybody wanted to go to the library. And I wasn't a big library kind of guy, you know. We didn't hang out around libraries. But I said, I'll go to the library for absolutely no reason at all. I wasn't thinking anything. And I went out. And they're at 33rd Street, Orange County jail there. Went to their library. And what it was just a big room full of books, you know. And you walk in for no reason. I turned to the left, and I walked right up to the books, and right at the end of my nose was the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And hopelessness makes this a very exciting book. Alcoholism, losing and failing and doing everything but dying, makes the book Alcoholics Anonymous very exciting reading. And when I got back to my cell, I opened this book up, and I started to read, and I saw my life. It was just like the lights came on for me. I remember reading in the third chapter two paragraphs about a jaywalker. And I said, this is me. This is me. This is me. And I connected with Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, I believe. I continued reading through the book, and I came to page 63, and I found a prayer that I'd sat in a dark apartment for 2 weeks and read over and over and over and over again. And when I saw that prayer, to me, it was like God himself was speaking to me. And I thought, you know, all the meetings I'd been to and all that I'd read and the prayers I'd said, I think the combination of all those things, I began to have a desire within to try to make Alcoholics Anonymous work for me. And I wanted it. And that was 16 years ago. And I want to tell you this. I want it today. And I want it more today than I've ever wanted it before. And it's more important for me today to do the things contained within the pages of this book than ever before. And to unite with you people than ever before. And I've been different since that day. And when they shipped me back to Seminole County Jail, I came back ready to do whatever it took to be one of you. And I would give old Jerry, and I said, Jerry, just please tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. And Jerry said, Lee, I cannot tell you what to do, but I'll show you what I did. And Jerry pointed me again to the book Alcoholics Anonymous and said, Lee, we have a program. Jerry said, he told us all the guys that were at the meeting, you fellas, they're not going to be 90 meetings in 90 days where they're taking you. You're going to have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Jerry said, I can't promise you a good job. Maybe one of these days you'll get a good job. Maybe you won't. I can't promise you a wonderful relationship. Maybe one of these days you'll have a wonderful relationship. Maybe you won't. He said, Lee, what we can promise you, that if you would do the things in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that you can have a relationship with a power greater than yourself that can make your life mighty wonderful. And I talked to several new people just before the meeting tonight. Man, I'm so happy to know that there are so many new people here at this conference. I think it's tremendous that we had some people that are relatively new in sobriety get up and read tonight. I know I had 5 years of sobriety. I got up to read something once in my heart. I felt like it was going to pound out of my chest. It's an absolute miracle that you guys were able to get up here and stand erect the whole time. But I want to encourage you new people. You know, I would go to Jerry and I'd say, Jerry, I'm a goner. There's nothing that can help me. I've tried it all. If you're in this room tonight and you feel that way, if you've exhausted every avenue of hope, if there's no place left for you to turn, if you've used up everybody, every resource, if there's no place left for you to go, that makes you an excellent candidate for sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'd get old Jerry and say, Jerry, I don't believe I can do this thing. I'm not smart enough to do this thing. Jerry, I've never even read a book. And let me assure you of this too. This deal is not dependent on individual skills or abilities or intelligence that you may or may not have. This deal's for everybody. This truly is God's deal. We come in here with what we've got and a whole lot of what we don't have, and we do the best that we can do. And my best was just like that. But when I applied my best to this program, God took this and He made this out of it. And I see Him do it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. I can't explain it. I don't want to explain it. All I want to do is do it. Alcoholics Anonymous will not work for people that need it. Alcoholics Anonymous will not work for people who want it. Alcoholics Anonymous can only work for people who do it. I heard a story recently that really is the best third step story I've ever heard. Especially pertinent for you new people here tonight. It's about a family, and they were laying in bed, and they were asleep, and all of a sudden they heard crash, boom, bam. And they woke up, and they raised up in the bed, and the room was filled with smoke, and crash, their door to their bedroom came falling down, and firemen ran into their room with their goggles and masks on and carried them, picked them up, and were grabbing their children out of the other rooms and ran outside of the house through the flames and everything. And when they got outside, they looked around, and one of their children was missing. And they looked upstairs, and there was just smoke bellowing out of this room, this window from the child's room. And the father called up and said, son, son, son. And he'd hear, daddy, daddy. He'd say, come to the window, come to the window. And he could just see his little arm stick out of the window through that smoke like this. And he said, son, jump, jump. And the son said, father, I can't see you. I can't jump. I can't see you. And the father said, jump, son, because I can see you. Let me tell you, if you're in this room and you're new and you hadn't done the things in this book yet, I want you to know that your house is on fire. Here is a way out. Run for it. Run for the door. If you're new, I want to encourage you. Don't waste any more time. How much more time do you think you have? And it's what you're holding on to really worth dying for. I'd like to tell you, I got down to business with the plan of recovery in this book. Jerry, he led anybody that was willing to do it through the process of recovery in this book. And I did the best that I could do with each of these steps where I was at, including the amend steps. And I had plenty of time to do it there. I'd like to tell you that when I went before the judge, that when I told him all about AA and how well I was doing, he just looked at me and said, boy, that's great. You can go home right now. That did not happen for me. He said, we're going to give you a little something to help you think about what you did, you know. And he gave me some time. And I got my first 2 years of sobriety in a correctional facility. And I look back at that today, and I thank God for it. I needed every minute of it. I needed every day of those 2 years off the street. And God used every second of it in my life. But when I got to my permanent camp, it had been 2 weeks since I'd been in the county jail and seen Jerry, and been 2 weeks since I'd been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, had contact with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when they brought us in off the bus, we were all chained together on the bus, you know, and there was a guy in there mopping the floor, and I said, hey, do they have AA here? And he goes, yeah, I think there's a meeting tonight. I said, oh boy, you know. And they put us in a cell block, and they said, you men are all in orientation. For the next 72 hours, we're going to keep you here isolated in population. Everything you do will be in here, and we're not going to let you mix with anyone else. I said, man, I want to go to that AA meeting tonight. And I watched one guy walk over to the CO, and he said, I need to go to the telephone. I need to call my attorney. He said, no. I said, wow, I want to go to that AA meeting tonight. Another guy walked over. I said, I'm out of cigarettes. I need to go to the commissary. He said, no. I said, boy, I want to go to that AA meeting. I put my head down and said, God, I'd sure like to go to that meeting tonight. I'm just going to put it in your hand. And I got up and I walked over to the correctional officer and I said, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to go to that meeting tonight. He looked at me and said, well, go ahead. And God will give us what we need. You know that? We don't always get what we want, but God has always, always given me just what I've needed. My job in this deal is to want what He wants for me. And I think back, you know? I think back about that, you know, and it's a nice, cool evening there in Florida tonight. I would imagine that that officer, maybe sometimes he thinks back, too. I can just see him right now, sitting on his porch swing, smoking a cigarette, reflecting back. I can just hear him thinking right now, why did I let that guy go, you know? But I see stuff like that happen all the time around here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got very active and busy in the meetings that we had there, on the meeting we had there on the compound. We had one big meeting a week. There was always 75 or 80 guys there. I said, wow, Alcoholics Anonymous is popular here. And we had cake and coffee, and then the two outside female sponsors would come in, you know. Wasn't very long, I figured out why the meetings were so popular. Just good cake, I guess. But boy, they would let me participate, and they would let me chair the meetings, and I would get up and chair the meeting, and sometimes none of the guys would want to share, or no one would want to be involved at all. And when that would happen, I'd just bust the book open and start reading. Boy, they didn't like that very much. But it helped me a lot, and I stayed sober. Me and some other, there were a few guys there that were serious about AA and really wanted this deal. And we got together and we were talking. You know, we could meet 2, 3, and 4 guys out on that compound, but they do not allow numbers of people to meet, you know, and there's good reasons for that. But we wanted another meeting. You know, I was at Tom Ice Correctional Conference there in Area 51 a few years ago, and what a fantastic conference that is, too. After 3 days of sharing and going to meetings and panel meetings and discussions after the meetings and really talking about this thing, there were two things that came very clear to me. One is that more meetings are needed inside our facilities. And the second thing is that if a guy will wait until he gets out before he starts doing something about changing his life, he will not make it. And what we wanted was another meeting. So we talked about it. We said, well, what we'll do is we'll go all around the compound and ask everybody here, and maybe we'll find somebody that will help us do this. And we asked everybody there, and they said, no, you know. And we would get together and talk, and they'd say, we've forgotten where we're at. You know, we're just numbers. We're convicts. They're not going to do anything like this for us. And one of the guys said, well, hey, let's pray about it. You know, and we don't know what prayer is. We only know that it is. And we started praying about it. And it was about a couple of months later, they came to us from this department there, and they said, you know what? We've thought about it. We've got a night. There's nothing going on. If you guys want to have that meeting, you can have that meeting. And, boy, we had our meeting. And we said, thank you, you know. And, boy, I got some books and some literature and found a room and straightened the chairs. I named the meeting. I kind of felt like I was in charge. We had the first meeting, and, boy, I was standing up there, and a guy said something. I said, hey, you can't say that here. That's against tradition. He said, well, which one? I said, I don't know. It's got to be against one of them. He jumped over the table on me and was going to fire me up. It was a mess, just a complete mess. And all the next week, I prayed and prayed about it. I said, God, what am I going to do, you know? I can't let these guys, these idiots, take over this thing, you know? They'll ruin it. So I prayed about it all week. And the next week, I went to the meeting. I was standing there in the doorway thinking, what am I going to do? And some of the guys came over to me and said, Lee, we've talked about it. We've decided that if you'll sit right over there and be quiet, we'll let you stay. And they did okay. And at that time, in my life, there's nothing that meant more to me than that hour and those men and that we could be together. Let me tell you what happened to me as a result of putting into practice a program of recovery explained in this book. And being involved in service in Alcoholics Anonymous is any way I could be used. On Saturday mornings, it's real quiet on the compound. Most of the guys would sleep in. Now, I prayed every day. But this was my opportunity to get out really early on that yard, and I would have a little privacy. And I could practice my 11th step. And I'd get up really early. And I was out there one Saturday morning. And I was out there, I was just talking to God, you know. And I could feel a breeze, you know, coming by my face. I could feel the warmth of the sun. And I could hear the birds, you know. And I was talking to God, and I realized that I was happy. And for the first time in my life, I knew that my life was really going somewhere, and it was okay to be me. I mean, I was in prison, and I felt like $1 million. And you're not supposed to feel that way in prison. You're supposed to be filled with despair. You're supposed to know that there is no hope. You're supposed to be lost. You're supposed to be alone. You're supposed to be filled with fear and filled with hate. But my roots had grasped new soil. And inside of me, there was a willingness to believe that God was guiding my life and taking me to something better. I was not happy to be in prison, but I found happiness in the midst of prison because He was with me. Augustine wrote, "Thou hast made us for Thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in Thee." They suggested that the day you get out, you go straight to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the day I got out, there were two men that I'd been locked up with that were out working programs, came and picked me up and took me straight to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was scared to death. I felt like I had prison written across my forehead. I walked into that meeting, little discussion meeting. They were all in a circle. I had my head down. It was my turn to share. I had my head down. I said, "I just got out of jail." And I couldn't have said prison for anything. They said, "Well, we're glad you're out of jail." Man chairing the meeting. He said, "That's good. That's good. And if you really mean business about doing something about your drinking, you've come to the right place." You didn't care where I'd been or what I'd done. All you cared about was what I was willing to do about my recovery and how you could help me. And that's all I've ever found in Alcoholics Anonymous, was people that wanted to help me no matter what. I've never been asked to leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never been told I was too bad that I couldn't make it here. I've always heard, "Lee, if you'll do it, it'll work for you. If you put forth the action necessary, it'll work for you. And if you don't drink today, you'll never have to take another drink, because it's always today. And if you don't drink, you can't get drunk." I went to 110 meetings my first 90 days out, 100 the next 90, and 90 the next 90. And I just lived in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And people would pick me up and take me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked to a lot of AA meetings, and I rode a bicycle to a lot of AA meetings. And everybody just got around me and tried to do everything they could do to make sure that I had the best opportunity at this thing that I could have. And you know what I did? I caused trouble immediately. I was only out a couple of weeks. I was in the meeting, and we all stood up to close with the Lord's Prayer. I put my hand out, and I felt this little tiny hand slip itself into mine. And whoa, you know. I felt something I hadn't felt in a while. Now, everybody knows that after the meeting, you're supposed to go to the Golden Lamb for coffee. But that night, this woman and I, we went someplace else. Now, I was so dumb, I did not realize that just anything could happen if a man and a woman went off together alone. And it was that evening that anything happened, you know. And so the next day I got up, boy, I had a big grin across my face. Went to work, worked all day, got to the meeting. They were saying the Serenity Prayer. I raised my head up. There were 30 people around two big tables. I looked down at the other end. I saw that woman. I said, "There she is, boy." And I looked at her and I said, and she was crying. And I said, "My goodness, she's crying. She's upset. Something must have happened today to upset her. I was just with her last night, and everything was great, you know." And they asked, "Does anyone have anything to share?" And she said, "I feel like I've been used." I said, "Oh, you know what I said." She said, "I feel like I've been used by him." I said, "Oh, my God, they're going to throw me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've blown it now. They're never going to let me come back." There was a little old-timer there by the name of A. Lee. said, "Honey, if you don't like the way it feels, don't ever do it again." And probably saved my life. I don't think I ever could have come back. After the meeting, guy from the halfway house came over to me and said, "Lee, how'd that feel?" I said, "Boy, that didn't feel very good at all." He said, "Guess what? If you don't ever do that again, you'll never have to feel that way again." Boy, I wish I'd gotten that lesson the first time. They suggested a sponsor. I looked around the room. Everybody else had one. It looked like the popular thing to do. I certainly wanted to be popular. So I asked this fellow named Butch. "Don't ever ask anybody named Butch to be your sponsor." It might be him. "Don't ever ask anybody named Butch or Killer to be your sponsor." Boy, that guy was something else. I went to him one time. I thought he ought to loan me a little money. He told me to shut up. He said I was stupid. He said, "Get in there and go down and sit on the front row. That's where the stupid people sit." No offense. I went to Butch another time. I had some complaints. I said, "I think I'll write all my complaints down. I'll share this with Butch, you know." And I wrote them all down, you know. I said, "Butch, look at this. I've done a lot of work. I want to show you this." And I said, "I don't like this, and I don't like this, and I don't like this, and this stinks, and what do you think about that? And look at this guy, you know." And he goes, "Wow, you're not very happy with what you found here." I said, "No, I'm not." He goes, "Well, maybe you ought to just go get drunk. See how you like that." I said, "Boy, I don't want to get drunk." He goes, "Well, you're not very happy with this. You probably will get drunk." So I got happy. I said, "Boy, maybe this stuff isn't as bad as I thought, you know." For me, gratitude is the hinge on which the gate of sobriety swings. I've never seen a grateful alcoholic get drunk. And never have I ever seen a person fail that thoroughly enjoyed this path. And boy, what a path do we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You could never have explained to me what I was going to find when I came in here to be with you. I didn't know if I wanted what you had. All I knew is I didn't want what I had. September the 12th, 1986, I was released from the penitentiary for what I know to be the last time. March 30th, 1992, Division of Pardons and Paroles released me out off paper after 15 and a half years early, by the way. That's after having spent 17 and a half years of my life in the correction system, either inside or on some kind of paper, waiting to go back, knowing I was going to go back, knowing that was going to be my life. And I did not bring anything here with me that could have produced that for me. You know, I mean, I came here with a shoebox, with some letters, a few pencils, one change of socks, and one change of underwear. But everything in life that I needed to have any success at all met me at the door when I came here. I had 11 jobs the first 18 months that I was out. I wasn't any better at that sober than I was drunk. Every job I had one thing really wrong with it, you know. They wanted me to work. I was having a terrible time. And, you know, I'd go to these meetings. These guys, they really mistreat you, you know. They don't give any breaks at all. They were really putting a lot of pressure on me. And I was walking into the jail meeting one night, and late one evening and afternoon, and the guy was walking out, and we were talking, and he said, "Well, you know, you could work where I work. You work where I work." Hand me this guy's card and said, "Call him tomorrow. I'll put in a good word for you, you know." And I said, "All right." Now, I went to that meeting, and then later I went to my regular meeting that night, and I got there, and those guys said, I said, "Look at this card, you know. Hey, maybe I'll get this job, you know. And, you know, get a job." Okay, okay. So I called this guy the next day, and they said, "Yes, we need some people immediately. Come down here tomorrow, 10 o'clock. Bring your resume. Click." I said, "Resume? What am I going to put on some kind of resume? Bad, big mistake, you know. You know, state prison. You know? I can't go down there, you know." And I went to the meeting that night, and they said, "Did you call that guy?" I said, "Yes, I called him. Big mistake I almost made. They wanted a resume." They said, well, we think you ought to go down there and talk to that guy. We think you ought to go down there and tell him the truth. I said, I can't do that, you know. Anyway, they suggested they might not want any bother with me anymore if I wasn't willing to go down there. And so, boy, I went home that night, and I just, God, I said, what am I going to do? And I prayed about it. And I said, God, I've got to go down to this place tomorrow. I mean, you know, this is going to be awful, you know. I can't go down there, you know. You're going to have to go with me, you know. And if I'm going, you're going with me, you know. I got up the next morning and said, okay, we're going down to this place. We're not going to be there very long, you know. I walked into that guy's office. He had a phone in each hand. And hung those phones up, told me, sit down over there. I sat down. He said, where's your resume? I said, I don't have a resume. He said, well, no big deal. Do you have any experience in sales? And the moment he said that, it was like a light went off in my mind. And I said, well, yeah. I've sold microwaves and stereos and guns and clothes and cars and coats and furs and jewelry. He said, wow, you got a lot of experience. Think I get you a star tomorrow? I said, yeah, man, I sold that guy's product like popcorn. I didn't have to sneak down the alley with it and keep it covered up with a blanket and hide it in the trunk of my car. You just walk up to anybody, you know. I don't think God minds it at all that we have a little something and do pretty good here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I take God near where I go today. I'd rather walk in the dark with God than walk alone in the light. It is better to walk with God by faith than to walk alone by sight. Listen to this. I've become a regular guy. I have a job. I have a car. I have clothes. I live somewhere. I went back to school. I was down in an intergroup office one day, and they said, asked me if I wanted to be on the service committee. I volunteered for the service committee. Man, after a year on the service committee, I felt so confident. I said, man, this is important. I must be important, you know. This is valuable. I have value. Man, I felt so good about myself. I said, I'll go back to school, you know. And I went back to school and got an education. I was in a meeting once and I heard a lady say, I woke up at 4 o'clock this morning and I love what I do for a living so much that I just laid in bed and thought about going to work, you know. I said, God, I don't feel that way at all, you know. And I was praying about it. I said, God, isn't there anything? I mean, I'm grateful to have a job and to be able to live and have tires and stuff like that. I said, but isn't there anything out there for me, something that I would like doing that might make a contribution or something like that or be helpful to other people? And, you know, early on in AA, when I first started coming to AA, I heard a guy in a meeting say once, Lee, if you take care of God's business, he'll take care of your business. And I thought about it, and I said, well, God, I don't know anything else to do. I'll just work with all these new guys I can and take every job in AA I can take, and I'll just stay as busy in AA as I can, you know. And my experience is, if you take care of God's business, he'll give you a business, because he did that for me. I'll tell you this. Sometimes I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm so excited about going to work that I just lay in bed, and I cannot go back to sleep. I love what I do so much. And what a blessing that is. Every day is a vacation when you love what you do. I'm going to close. Before I do, I want to share a little bit about my 9-step. The guys I work with, there are several areas of this program that the fellows seem to have a lot of problems with. One, of course, is the God thing. Boy, these guys, they have a lot of trouble with God. You know, they don't like the idea of that at all. And I like what Dr. Bob says about that. If you are an atheist or an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which might interfere with you being able to accept what we have to offer here, I feel sorry for you. You know, it's a pretty easy door that we need to crack open just the barest minimum. Your own conception, anything you want is okay. You can have it any way you want, right there. But you have to believe something or be willing to. Another area the guys I work with have trouble is with the 5th step. And it's very difficult to really get serious with that sometimes. my experience with the fifth step, I did my first one in a county jail. And, you know, there were guys that came in sometimes that would say, don't do that. I'm going to tell you, do it. You know, big deal. Most of my stuff was a matter of public record anyway. I'll tell you what's hard to share in jail is fear. You know, it's easy to talk about the people you hate, but it's hard to talk about being afraid. You know, that was just something that telling people you're afraid of being vulnerable in some way. But I was willing to do it, and I did it. Now, I can't say my first fifth step that I really identified a lot of defects of character or anything like that. But all my life, I've been one person on the outside and someone else on the inside. I'd always had a secret lead that nobody got to see. After I did my first fifth step, for the first time in my life, I wasn't two halves anymore. I was one whole person for the first time in my life. Another area, of course, is the ninth step. A lot of people look at that ninth step and it's just, they probably feel about the same way I felt about it. My sponsor, he didn't let me lay around very long at all. He said, Lee, you'll never get over alcoholism until you've done all you can to clean up your past. And he sat down with me and we did an eighth step list together. And, I was out in the world and working, having jobs and stuff like that. And boy, he said, he just gave me the boot. He said, you get out there and start trying to clean up this mess you've made. You pick out the first one or the second one or the third one on that list, and you get out there and get started now. And one day I just grabbed the bull by the horns, and I went out to try to clean up the mess I'd made. And, I'd look at that list, and I'd say, how am I going to repay whole communities or cities, for the harm that I've caused them? Boy. But there were several things on my list that were a real problem for me, my father. I couldn't go to my father. My father was dead, my father had been killed. I could not go to him. In our book it says, like Scott said last night, there are people that we cannot see, and we write them an honest letter. And so I wrote my dad an honest letter, and I visited my father at his graveside, and I read him the letter. And every time I'm in that area, I go by my father's day grave, and I visit my father, and I speak to my father. And there was a time in my life, well, I didn't have good thoughts about my father. And I felt like I'd been kind of done wrong or something like that, But just from going and doing what the book says, I don't feel that way about my father. That's changed today. When I think of my father today, I see a completely different picture than I used to. I remember as a small child, my father getting on his knees with me and having me get on my knees and trying to teach me how to pray. And I think of that and I think, wow, what a great father I had. Few people have a father like that. And so I have a completely different idea of my father today than I did at one time. Another area was I'd committed a lot of crimes. I'd committed many, many, many crimes. And I didn't have any idea what I would do about that. My sponsor referred me to a fellow that had been sober a long, long, long time. Charlie L., who was known as the Arkansas Traveler. At that time, he was sober well over 40 years. He passed on a couple of years ago with 52 years of sobriety. But I went and talked to Charlie, and Charlie said, Lee, I said, Charlie, look here. The book says maybe we need to go back to jail. Sometimes we've got to be face jail and stuff. And Charlie said, well, let's talk about this, And he said, Lee, I believe there's other ways to clean this stuff up, too. And I was at the meeting one night, and what I did, there was a fellow, his name was on the board. He said, wanted to go to meetings, And so what I would do is I started picking up Saul and taking Saul to meetings. Now, on Saul's last drunk, he lost both his legs. That's what happened to him last time he took a drink. So what you do is you go and you get him, and you pick him up and put him in the front seat, you wrap the wheelchair up, put it in the trunk, drive to the meeting, get the wheelchair out, pick him up and put him in the chair and take him into the meeting. When I first started doing that, I said, boy, this is kind of difficult. I'm not too sure about this. But after 30 days, it was like the richest part of my life. And I couldn't wait to get over there and get that guy and take him to meetings. After 9 months, we were all fighting over taking him to the meetings, You had to get there real early to get him, We'd run him in the meeting there and He'd share the same thing every week. We'd read that third chapter. We were like men who had lost our legs. All the new people would lean over and look at Saul, and Saul would say, This is what happened to me the last time I took a drink, boy. What a powerful, powerful, powerful message that guy had. There's no telling how many people he saved with it. I come from a very large family. You know, my men's list is, of course, my family. And my grandparents loved me more than any two people in my life. And I'd hurt them so bad over and over and over and over and over again that the rest of my family, my uncles, they'd watched me do this. And they were very skeptical of my recovery, and they weren't too sure about me at all. And they were very reluctant to have anything to do with me. But after I was out of prison for 1 year, I flew to Little Rock and visited my family, my grandparents. And I would come in on a Friday. And Saturday morning I got up and I would go out in the community and make a few amends. Some place I used to work that I would steal from, or an apartment where I lived that I destroyed. And I would also visit my older relatives who could not get out, and I have a handicapped cousin, I would visit him. And on Saturday night, I'd go down to Wolf Street to a meeting. Sunday morning, I'd spend all day with my family, and I'd give my grandparents all day. And, you know, and I'd done that for several years, and I'd come in on a Friday. Saturday, I'd get out and make a few amends, visit my older relatives that couldn't get out, my handicapped cousin. Sunday night, go to a meeting. Saturday, I go to a meeting. Sunday morning, I would, I'd be at my grandparents, and one of my uncles would come by, or one of my aunts would call, or something like that, and speak to me. I'd been out of prison for 8 years, and I'd been coming to Little Rock for 7 years, and I was 10 years sober, and I came in on a Friday. I got up Saturday morning, visited my older relatives, my handicapped cousin. Saturday night, went to a meeting. But on Sunday morning, 40 members of my family came over to my grandparents' house to be with me. One of my uncles came over to me and said, "Lee, there's just something about you that makes people want to be together." And I thought to myself, I know what it is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. I really appreciate what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I cannot fit AA into my life. AA is my life. I've said that sometimes, and people say, "Well, boy, it's not my life. I came here so I could have a life." And I say, "Well, good for you. But that's not what I want. I want this. And I want to go anywhere Alcoholics Anonymous can take me." I'm going to close with a quick story. It's one that really helped me for anybody maybe having a problem with this higher power thing. In 1989, in Armenia, a father walked his son to school one morning. He took his son to the steps of the school, and then he walked several blocks to where he was working. That day in Armenia, they had an earthquake, and that city was absolutely destroyed. And that father miraculously drug himself out of the rubble of the building he was in and ran to that school past fires and people screaming, emergency vehicles. And when he got to the steps of the school, it was just a pile of stone. And he ran to the top of the pile and started throwing rocks and throwing bricks and screaming out his son's name, "Armand, Armand, Armand, Armand." And people would come to him and say, "Let us help you. You're wounded. Let us bandage you." And he'd say, "Help me find my son. Help me find my son." And they would say, "He's delirious. We can't do anything for him." And they would go and help someone else. 36 hours later, he was still there, throwing rocks and throwing bricks and screaming out his son's name. After 36 hours, he heard something. He said, "Armand, is it you?" He heard, "Yes, Father, it's me." He said, "Son, are you all right?" He said, "Yes, Father, I'm all right. There are 13 of us in here. I told them that if my father is alive, he will not rest until he saves me. And after he helps me, he'll help you too." You new people, here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a father. In the fifth chapter, Bill wrote, "He is the Father, we are his children." In the closing of Dr. Bob's story, Dr. Bob wrote, "Your heavenly Father will never let you down. Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a heavenly spiritual father who will not rest until he saves you. He will not rest until he reaches you. And after he's helped you, he's going to use you to help somebody else. I love all of you, and thank you for helping me stay sober today.